Hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm Dean Welty with Rita Dunaway, and we are now on Chapter 6 in our review of Rita's new book entitled Restoring America's Soul. Now, for those who may be new to Crossroads or maybe missed some of our earlier programs, let me give you a quick review. We began by talking about the importance of telling people what we as conservatives believe and what we are for, rather than just what we are against. It's what we do, working to conserve our rich heritage and all that is good. We went on to talk about the importance of tone and civility in all of our conversations and debates, particularly when we get into hot-button issues of politics, religion, and morality. That includes the need to listen carefully to others if we want them to listen to us. We moved on to talk about the importance of making decisions on the basis of what we know to be true and good, rather than on our feelings, which so often get us into trouble by telling us that, if it feels good, do it. So to finish up with part one of this two-part book, we reviewed how conservatism is connected to our great heritage of Judeo-Christian values and constitutional principles, and how our founding fathers applied their Christian beliefs to creating our system of government. But then we turned the corner last week into the second half of Rita's book, which takes on some of the more controversial issues in our culture today. We began by talking about caring for the poor. Well, that doesn't sound very controversial. But then we started debating about who does it better, liberals or conservatives. That starts stirring some interest. Then we have to ask ourselves whether it's better to take care of the poor ourselves, or can we just turn the job over to the government and let them handle it? After all, we pay our taxes, let them do it. But that then brings us to our topic for today, which is about protecting our religious liberty. That's a big one. But before we begin, some of our new listeners may also be asking, well, what qualifies Rita, or anyone else for that matter, to take on this challenging task of restoring America's soul? Well, I'll try to answer that by saying, first of all, that she is a constitutional attorney with honors degrees from West Virginia University and the Washington and Lee University School of Law. Following that, she worked as staff counsel for the Rutherford Institute as an allied attorney for the nationally respected Alliance Defending Freedom, and now as the national legislative strategist for the Convention of States Project. That's a mouthful. But going on, she's also a syndicated columnist who has written for numerous media outlets, including her weekly column for the Daily News Record. And as we all know so well, she is the co-host of our Crossroads programs. But finally, and most importantly, she is committed to serving her young family as a wife and mother right here in the Valley. All that to say, we are very fortunate, Rita, to have you with us again today. But before we begin, can you tell our listeners how they can get a copy of your book so they can follow along next week as we go through the rest of it?
Thanks, Dean. I'd like to encourage our listeners to pick up their copy of my new book at Blessings Christian Bookstore. Blessings Christian Bookstore is one of our great sponsors for this program, so I'd love to have our listeners support them. They have a great store that you'll be happy to visit, even if you weren't looking for a new book. And they're located at 313 Neff Avenue, which is right behind the Valley Mall. And listeners can also order the book online at ritamdunaway.com. That's also a good place to look if you want to read some of my most recent columns. So I encourage people to visit my website as well.
Okay, Rita. Well, let's jump into it. Our next chapter, Chapter 6, is about protecting religious liberty. And I'm interested that you start out by pointing out that the very first words of the Bill of Rights are the words that protect religious freedom, the very first of the Bill of Rights. That was no accident, was it?
Not at all. Religious liberty was very dear to the founding fathers. And to paraphrase a quote by James Madison, the founders believed that when we become members of a civil society, we must always do so with a saving of our allegiance to the universal sovereign. That's a pretty serious conviction.
And it reminds me of what President Reagan once said, "Without God, there is a coarsening of society. And without God, democracy will not and cannot long endure." So if we ever forget that we're one nation under God, then we will soon be a nation gone under. He was a prophet.
Yep, a wise man.
But Rita, this goes back long before our founding fathers to our earliest settlers with the Pilgrims from the Puritans in the early 1600s. The most important achievement for them in coming across a broad, dangerous ocean was winning their religious liberty, which had been denied to them in England. They were now free to worship, to teach the Bible to their children, to form their colonial governments according to biblical precepts, and in keeping with their strongly held Christian beliefs. It was this same adherence to their deeply held beliefs and biblical teaching that was continued through to our founding fathers, as we discussed last week. And it influenced the drafting of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, which remains the blueprint for our system and government today. Well, sadly, however, and as President Reagan prophesied, even with these deep roots, it seems that this strong commitment to religious liberty is waning. In fact, according to a Pew Research Center survey done just a few years ago, nearly a quarter of Americans now claim to have no religious beliefs at all.
That is really troubling, Dean, and that is why any efforts at restoring America's soul have to include renewing that strong commitment to religious liberty that was such a central component of America's soul from the beginning.
That's right, Rita. But in this chapter, you also spend a little time just getting us up to speed on how the First Amendment protects religious freedom. And it can be confusing to those who've never studied it.
Yeah, I think that's right. There are two separate clauses in the First Amendment, both of which protect religious freedom.
Well, you're talking about the first part, which says that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That's only a small part of that First Amendment, but it's an important one.
Yep, exactly. So the first part of that, which says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, is referred to as the Establishment Clause. The second part, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, is known as the Free Exercise Clause.
Well, Rita, the way these clauses are spoken of today creates a lot of confusion, I think, because we hear that the Establishment Clause requires, quote, the separation of church and state, even though that phrase is not mentioned anywhere in the Constitution.
Right.
Now, that may surprise some of our listeners because it is often referred to as the constitutional separation of church and state. And the problem is that when it is interpreted wrongly, this establishment clause can become a weapon against expressions of faith in the public square rather than as a shield from attacks by an overreaching federal government, as it was originally intended. Therefore, it does seem like the two clauses are at odds with each other. Wouldn't you say?
Well, that's just it. And that is not what the drafters intended at all. When you look at all the different drafts that were considered for the religious clauses in the First Amendment, virtually all of them shared two elements. First, they all aimed at precluding the establishment of one national religion or sect, which would have the effect of coercing citizens to support that national religion in various ways through their taxes. And second, they all aimed to ensure that individuals would remain free to practice their own faith and live according to their convictions.
I know you're going to address this later, but that affected only a national religion, the establishment of a national religion. It said nothing about the states.
No, Congress can make no law. Right.
Exactly. In fact, several states did have a state-approved religion. Well, that's interesting because the only one these two clauses that we hear about anymore is the Establishment Clause, misquoted as the Constitutional Establishment Clause, which it is not. But it generally means that you can never speak or write in the public square about your faith. That's a misguided interpretation. And you refer in your book to a very specific ruling that really turned the Establishment Clause on its head. Can you help us with that?
Yeah, it happened in the 1947 Supreme Court case Everson versus Board of Education. That case involved a taxpayer's challenge to a New Jersey law that provided reimbursement to parents of both public and private school children who used public transportation, like a public bus, to get to school. The taxpayer claimed that this violated the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. And the Supreme Court held that even though the First Amendment clearly applies only to Congress, as you said, Congress shall make no law, the 14th Amendment's protection of liberty against state governments also incorporated the entire Establishment Clause and made it applicable to the states as well. So this was a sea change in the reading and application of the Establishment Clause.
Now just remind us, what was that 14th Amendment really all about?
Well, the 14th Amendment was part of the whole end of slavery and ensuring citizenship. That's what it was really about.
And so they really wanted the states to observe that same freedom regarding the slavery issue, but then it got broadened.
Exactly.
Okay. So even though the purpose of the Establishment Clause was to preclude only the federal government from establishing a national religion, the Supreme Court said it would now use the 14th Amendment to apply the Establishment Clause against state governments as well. So what do you make of that?
Well, it's really interesting, you know, if the Supreme Court were going to consistently apply the Establishment Clause in the way it was intended, which is a protection of individual liberty by ensuring that no citizen would ever be compelled to support an official government religion, then I think it would make sense to say that the 14th Amendment protects that liberty from state coercion as well. But the reason, Dean, that it doesn't make any sense is because the court no longer interprets the Establishment Clause that way. According to the court, the Establishment Clause now has nothing to do with individual liberty. It's more about making sure no one ever gets the impression, because they might be offended, that the government is even generally supportive of religion, even if it's supportive of all religion. We can't let anyone get that impression because they might be offended. That's what it's about today, according to the court.
Rita, I don't mean to be mean-spirited, but how could such bright people be so obtuse? It's ridiculous. It's absurd because throughout most of our history, Americans have been free to express their religion without fear of government interference. We have already talked about how they were able to worship, teach their children, form their governments in accordance with their Christian beliefs and biblical principles. And as we discussed last week, the largest single source referred to in our Founding Fathers' writings was the Bible. They frequently proclaimed national prayers of thanksgiving, of repentance, and fasting. They held church services in our government buildings. And in addition, those buildings and monuments in Washington contain many references to God. We even have "Under God" in our Pledge of Allegiance, "In God We Trust" as our national motto, and it's inscribed on all of our currency. So it is preposterous to now suggest that there should be no mention of God and no Christian crosses or similar displays on government property. Maybe you can explain that in a minute, but one more thing. Rita, you mentioned that under the modern interpretation of the Establishment Clause, the court is worried about people getting the impression that government is actually supportive of religion. Now, how does that play out?
Well, in one of the most popular analyses that the court uses today, it looks to see whether any bystander might perceive any type of government endorsement of religion. Therefore, in the case of public displays of nativity scenes, for instance, around Christmas time, the court will look to see, under all the circumstances, whether anyone who sees the display might think that the government supports the nativity scene or that it likes it more than the other. So I kid you not, Dean, we have federal courts doing things like counting candy-striped poles and looking to see how many dancing bears and Santa Clauses are combined with the nativity scene to make sure the message couldn't possibly be perceived as making Christmas more about the birth of Christ than it is about Santa Claus and the teddy bears and all that other stuff.
Well, Rita, I don't want to repeat myself about bright people, but that's the Establishment Clause, which seems today to be grossly misinterpreted from its original intent. But putting that aside, can you tell us about the condition of the Free Exercise Clause, which, of course, guarantees citizens the right to practice their faith? Has that, too, been butchered?
Well, sadly, Dean, the Free Exercise Clause took a big hit back in 1990 in a case called Employment Division versus Smith. In that case, the Supreme Court ruled that the First Amendment doesn't really provide any special protection for religious exercise if the law in question is neutral toward religion and generally applicable. So, in other words, unless the law is specifically meant to target believers for unfair treatment, the Free Exercise Clause doesn't really help them all that much.
This is getting sadder and sadder. But I know, Rita, that Congress did step up in response to that decision and passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act back in 1993. Now, that really heightens the legal protection for religious exercise, doesn't it?
That's right. But the catch, Dean, is that Congress could only make that apply to federal law. It's not binding on the states, and so that is why many of the states, including Indiana, as we discussed a couple of weeks ago, have passed their own state religious freedom restoration laws.
Well, in this chapter, Rita, you also point out that the battle for religious freedom has taken a sinister turn since the time when you were working at the Rutherford Institute several years ago. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
I would love to, Dean, because this is a really troubling development that I think all Christians need to really be aware of. Back then when I was at the Rutherford Institute, and this was not even 10 years ago, it seemed like so many of the First Amendment cases dealing with religion that we saw in the courts had to do with the Establishment Clause issues that we were talking about a moment ago. So there were cases like, can the high school valedictorian give her testimony as part of her graduation speech? Or does that speech, because it's sponsored by the school, become government speech where, you know, we have to be careful we don't offend anyone? There were cases like, could a courthouse maintain a display of the Ten Commandments? And I'm sure all of our listeners have heard about and followed those cases. I remember one case I worked on back at the Rutherford Institute had to do with, could this elementary school age child hand out pencils to his classmates that had the story of the candy cane and how it represents Christianity? And there was a big fight over whether that was allowed. Those were the types of cases we used to see most often back then. Today, what we are seeing is a very different front emerging in this battle, and it's serious. What we see today is a very clear attack on the rights of conscience of believers, which is more in the nature of a free exercise claim. And it's persecution, plain and simple.
Well, Rita, you talked about courthouses having a display of the Ten Commandments. I think all of us remember when Judge Roy Moore was forced to take a display of the Ten Commandments from the courtyard in front of the courthouse. Well, you talk about the way these examples seem to be proliferating. It's a little bit like Chuck E. Cheese's used to have this whack-a-mole.
Yes.
And they're popping up all over the country.
Yeah.
And so there are lots of examples of that. Anti-Christian, anti-freedom bias, including, for example, a florist in Washington State, a cake maker in Oregon, a photographer in New Mexico, a printer and clerk of the court in Kentucky, a pizza shop owner in Indiana, the chief of the Atlanta Fire Department, and hundreds of other cases that go on and on and on and on. And one of the more prominent cases, and we discussed this several weeks ago, involved Baker Jack Phillips in Colorado, who, with the help of Alliance Defending Freedom, was vindicated by the Supreme Court after the state of Colorado tried to force him to bake a wedding cake for a same-sex wedding, right?
That's right. But because that case involved such clear hostility directed toward Jack's faith by the state of Colorado itself, in the way it handled his case, it was so obvious that they were just out to nail him because they despised his Christian faith. So because of that, the Supreme Court in its decision really emphasized that in making its ruling. And because of that element being present there, the decision may have limited impact on future cases. So, you know, what I mean is, if a future case like that were to come up again and the state were to appear to take a more neutral approach and lack all that obvious religious hostility, it's unclear how the case would come out.
If they had just gone after him because he was personally biased against the homosexual partners, it probably could have stood. But because they attacked his religion directly,
yes,
the Supreme Court was able to vindicate
him. Yeah, they really belittled his faith in an obvious way.
Well, so it still seems that there's an open question about how much protection will be given to a person whose religious faith forbids him or her from going along with the culture's new embrace of same-sex marriage, like the cases we just mentioned, and now the whole sexual orientation, gender identity, and transgender issues. Give them all kinds of quivers to be shooting at the person of faith.
I think that's correct. And what's really at the crux of the battle right now is whether our national commitment to religious liberty is stronger than its commitment to this much newer notion of sexual liberty. And of course, any student of history or anyone who just sits down and reads the Constitution would say that the answer should be obvious. There's nothing about sexual liberty in the Constitution. And yet, religious liberty is our first freedom. It's the first freedom mentioned in our Bill of Rights. But today, Dean, the problem is we face a culture that doesn't place all that much importance on history or on the actual words of the Constitution. They have this idea of the organic Constitution that changes with time, and basically the words can mean whatever we want them to mean today.
Well, again, it brings up Nancy Pelosi's quote,
yeah,
"Are you kidding? Does the Constitution really matter?"
Yeah, we should just weep over that.
Well, Rita, it's not a surprise, actually, because we got one of our first warnings where you're talking about religious liberty and sexual liberty. And that came from back in 2006 from someone who Obama later appointed to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. She's Chai Feldblum, who said that in cases which pitted religious liberty against sexual liberty, she could not foresee any situation in which religious liberty should win. So, Rita?
Yeah, that should just have us all shaking in our boots.
It's
chilling. Really should.
And now we're seeing the fruit of that attitude.
And think about the fact that today, this whole concept of sexual liberty, it goes beyond even sexual behavior, sexual orientation. It's now being made to extend to this idea of just what you want to say your sex is. It completely defies the whole idea of truth and reality. It's all about desire and feelings.
Okay, Rita, you're getting us all riled up here now. We're looking at you for an answer. Mm. What do you see now as the biggest pitfall that we need to avoid as we advocate for religious liberty?
Well, Dean, this is sometimes hard, but I think we really have to avoid taking the stance or even appearing to take the stance that we support religious liberty only for our religion.
Right.
Because then it isn't really religious liberty, is it? John Whitehead, who was my former boss at the Rutherford Institute, used to remind me all the time that all rights hang together. If I don't protect someone else's religious freedom, then my own freedom will eventually suffer. And sadly, I've run into some Christians who aren't interested in protecting religious freedom for someone of a different faith. And in addition to being bad government philosophy, I really think that's a poor witness, Dean. As a Christian, I can confidently advocate for everyone's freedom of religious exercise and expression because I know that what I believe is true. I don't need to worry that my faith is somehow going to be toppled by allowing others to believe differently because it's true. Nothing can topple it. So protecting everyone's religious liberty and freedom of religious expression is the way to go. It's the right thing to do.
Well, that's a good point. I couldn't agree more, but I'll add one more thing. We're asking about the pitfall that we need to avoid as we advocate for religious liberty. Take a stand.
Yes.
And take your hits, come what may.
Amen.
Do not compromise in your case, because if you do, it will ripple to other cases as well.
Absolutely.
Take a stand and do not yield to compromise your faith. Well, we've covered a lot of ground. We're almost out of time. But before we close, can you tell us again how to get a copy of your book and then give us that famous elevator speech on religious liberty?
I'd be glad to. I want to encourage our listeners to get on down to Blessings Christian Bookstore to purchase the book. It's located at 313 Neff Avenue here in Harrisonburg. They're a friend and a sponsor of the program, so I encourage you to get your book there. You can also order it online at my website, RitaMDunaway.com.
Rita, I'll say on that, a lady came up to me at church on Sunday. She had two copies of that book that she's gotten from Blessings. So I would just say, get there before they're sold out.
Absolutely. Okay, ready for the elevator
speech?
All right,
let's go. Press the button.
Here it goes.
Okay.
Religious liberty is the cornerstone of our Bill of Rights. The First Amendment protects every person of faith in his or her effort to worship according to the dictates of his or her conscience, whether that person adheres to a majority or minority religion. This means that no one should ever be coerced to act in violation of his or her sincerely held religious beliefs unless there is some highest order government interest at stake that cannot be achieved through any other means. Commitment to a robust interpretation of the First Amendment is good for every American because the First Amendment protects all of us from having our beliefs or ideas suppressed by the government. Freedom does require us to be exposed to the expression of beliefs that offend us or might hurt our feelings. But this is a price worth paying for liberty.
Okay, we're at 10th floor, so
okay,
unfortunately
we're
out of time. Thank you, Rita, for walking through these first six chapters of your book with us. If you're just joining us, our guest and co-host has been Rita Dunaway, author of a new book entitled Restoring America's Soul. She'll be back with us again next week to continue with part 7 of this series on how to put all these great ideas into practice. And she'll be focusing on what she calls the savvy pro-lifer. I'm eager to hear that. Well, since we have 3 more chapters of this book to go, I again encourage you to get your own copy so you can follow along with us. Blessings Christian Bookstore, 313 Neff Avenue, Harrisonburg, Virginia. Now, if you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with your friends, go to valleyfamilyforum.org and click on the link to Crossroads on the home page. We want to thank our generous sponsors at Blue Ridge Chimney Services, the dental practice of Scott Dunaway, and Blessings Christian Bookstore and New Beginnings Church for their support. Please let them help you with your needs and then thank them for helping to sponsor our Crossroads programs. I also want to say how grateful we are for all of your prayers and your encouragement. Please know that we love getting your cards and letters like this one from Donna, who said, "I try to plan my Sunday mornings around your program before leaving for church. God bless you and your courageous outreach to this community." Thank you, Donna, for being in touch. Now, we also want to thank so many of you for your financial support as well. If you would like to make a tax-deductible donation to help keep Crossroads on the air, you can do so by check to Crossroads at P.O. Box 881 Harrisonburg 22803. I'm Dean Welty with Rita Dunaway and engineer Robbie Meadows, inviting you to join us again next week at the Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. And until then, have a great week putting your faith into action.
This is the day that the Lord.